be your host. The Moth is true stories told without notes in front of a live audience. We have five stories for you this hour. Up first is Jonathan Ames. He's been with The Moth from the very beginning, and he's hosted more shows and told more main stage stories than anyone in the history of The Moth. He's known for being something of a risque storyteller, but fortunately for you public radio listeners, we found a story of his, a real romp that's a little less blue than the others. It's about going commando while sword fighting. Here's Jonathan Ames, live at The Moth.
Okay. In 1984, I was a sophomore at Princeton, and I was one of the captains on the fencing team. And I briefly want to explain fencing to you a little bit. For everyone, a few Jews knew what a moil was, and certainly the male Jews remember what a moil was. But for those of you who don't know what fencing is, I'm going to give you a quick lesson. So, quickly, fencing. There are three weapons. The most common weapon that people know about is the foil. And in foil, the torso is the target area. And you use the tip of the blade like that. And so just the torso, not the arms, only the torso. Another weapon is the épée. And with that weapon, the whole body is the target, including the feet, the legs, the head, everything. But again, you only use the point. Now, the weapon I fenced was saber. And it was, for me, the most dashing, the most romantic, the most Errol Flynn-like. Because the way you scored touches was a slashing motion. Oftentimes I have a real saber when I do this and you would have been in peril, but because I'm an expert, I merely would have just snipped a hair for a moment, but very lovely right in the front here. Anyway, so the saber is a slashing weapon and the whole target area is everything above the hips, including the head and the arms. And so you make cutting motions like that and you slash across the body and it's very dynamic. So I was the captain and I loved the romance of fencing. So I named all my fellow saber fencers after great swordsmen in history. There was Sir Gawain, the Green Knight, one sort of goofy freshman we called Don Quixote, and myself I named El Cid. I was a Charlton Heston fan. This was, I loved his face. This was before he was wearing that horrible wig and, you know, became an NRA spokesman, but even that was okay. He had a great face. You don't see faces like that every day. So I called myself El Cid after the great Charlton Heston role. Now, I had a secret goal that sophomore year at Princeton and while training, and that was to beat the number one saber fencer at Columbia, Russell Wilson. My lifetime record against Russell Wilson was about 0-13. I'd been fencing him all through high school. I'd been fencing him at Junior Olympics. He was always beating me. Once at a party at the Junior Olympics, he snubbed me socially, which only added to my growing wound. He trained in New York City with, like, expatriates, Russian coaches. He had incredible skill. He was snobby. He was also a little bit chubby, and he had these sophisticated moves. So his whole worldview was opposed to mine, and I was always losing to him. So my goal, my secret goal sophomore year, was to beat Russell Wilson. Now, to get ready for this, I would go for early morning lessons with my French fencing coach at Princeton, who was a gorgeous man. He had a bald head, not that that's gorgeous, but he had a bald head and beautiful gray eyes, kind of looked like Sean Connery. He'd been a commando in the Algerian War, the French-Algerian War, and he would train me early in the morning, coming at me with a steel rod to make my parries extra firm, because you block here, you block here, you block here for the head, and he'd come at me, El Cid, come on, El Cid, commando, commando, because he was big into being a commando, and he was seeing me as a possible commando, and he would come at me with a steel bar going, commando, commando, and I would get ready, and he would tell me to be in my unguard position, which is like this, you must have a band of steel in the groin, El Cid. I don't know why we had to have a band of steel down here, but, you know, it wasn't chased or anything like that, but he liked us to have a band of steel down here, come at me with this rod. Then afterwards, you know, he would tell me stories of the war, and he would often tell this one story. He'd go, one time, El Cid, I was walking along on patrol, and suddenly an electric cable shot me in the buttocks, and I went flying in the air 30, 40 feet. I was flying through the air, but then I landed on my feet like a cat, El Cid. That's how you have to be with balance when you fence, El Cid. And then 2 days later, he'd be like, El Cid, one time I was on patrol, and an electric cable struck me in the buttocks and I went flying through the air and then I landed on my feet like a cat. That's how you have to be. And I don't know, he was on some loop because every 2 or 3 days I would hear this electric cable story in the buttocks and flying through the air and I'd be like, yes, coach, you're the greatest. You know, he had a huge ego. He would claim that when he was my age, he could fly when he went at someone with his saber. You know, he goes, I became planar. You know, this was planar, like he would be totally flying through the air with his saber. And we somehow at the time, though, I sort of believed him. You know, he said it with such conviction. Anyway, so we were both training like crazy. Finally, the big meet against Columbia happened, and we took a van from Princeton up to Columbia, and the coach also wanted me to win terribly because his wife had left him and was shacking up with the Columbia's coach. He had a thing for swordsmen, I guess, and so he really wanted me to win. We both had a vendetta. So we go up to Columbia, and we're in the gym getting ready, and the Columbia team's not around. We're in our white outfits, stretching, starting to work out a little bit. And then suddenly the whole gym fills with Wagner music, the Ride of the Valkyries, right? This scary Wagner music. And for me, I'm Jewish, and I'm like, what is this, Wagner? You know, this is Rocky music for the Nazi party. This is horrible. And then suddenly the Columbia team comes racing in with their white outfits and their swords trying to intimidate us to this Wagner, like the Nazi party. And it only made me more incensed, made me want to beat Russell Wilson even more. So anyway, before I got to fence Russell Wilson, though, I fenced the lesser saber guy on the Columbia team, and I lost to him. I was so keyed on Russell Wilson, I lost, which was disastrous. But our team was still competing. So then finally I got to fence Russell Wilson, this bout I'd been training months for, these, you know, commando lessons with the iron rod in the morning, the buttock story, all so I could beat Russell Wilson. I get down in my band of steel. We're moving back and forth. I faint to his head, and I cut him across the belly, and I go up 1-0. Now, to win a fencing bout, you have to score 5 touches. And so I had gotten the first one. And when I scored a touch in fencing, the language of fencing is French. And so when I scored the touch, I went, Ella! And Ela means, and there, like, and there, you swine, you fool, you idiot, you know, you Londoner, or something like that. So I would go, you know, Ela! And I said it really loud, right? And then we're moving back and forth. He tried to cut me here. Boom! I hit him right in the head. I'm up 2-0. This is incredible. I'm winning. It's beautiful. Then he got a touch 2-1, but then I went ahead 3-1. This was wonderful. But then he started coming back 3-2, 3-3. It's like, oh no, you know, I got down on my band of steel. Then I went ahead 4-3. But then sure enough, he fainted my head, cut me across the belly. It was now tied 4-4. I could sense it going out of my hands. My inner loser was asserting itself. My whole Oedipal upbringing, my father was always trying to crush me to keep me out of my mother's bed and everything like that. And so I could just sense it was happening again. Oh no, I'm going to lose. It was 4-4. Now, when it's 4-4 in fencing, it's called La Belle, the beautiful touch, because it's like the touch right before death. You know, the French love the death, le petit mort, le grand mort, they love it all. And so 4-4 is La Belle, because if you're recreating a duel to the death, the next touch would be the death touch. So my coach calls timeout. I lift up my mask, and he starts speaking to me in French. Il va faire le contretemps. But at this point, I'm not absorbing any French. I'd been saying, hey, la, with every touch. Hey, la, you know, I couldn't get, that was the only French I could get out of me. Or in me, but he's giving me all these instructions with French, and I'm going, okay, coach, but I sense I'm going to lose. And so he walked off, my mask came down, and then he turned and looked at me with these beautiful bullet gray eyes he had, and he said, commando. And that was like our secret communication, commando, the iron rod, everything. Okay, I'm good. So I got down to my band of steel, and I decided to do something very risky. I tried to win by playing it defensive, because I knew Russell Wilson, he wanted to really humiliate me. And one way to humiliate a saber fencer, the hand would also be target area. And in fencing, you're supposed to keep your hand back, but to keep your balance, sometimes it would come forward. And even though it's sort of macho and Errol Flynn-like, it does look a little fey as you're kind of moving forward with this hand, kind of very genteel and, you know, the pinky up or something like that. But anyway, my hand was out, and I knew he was going to want to cut it to really defeat me terribly. So I kind of kept it out there, almost like a trout fisherman with a lure. Come on, Russell Wilson, go for my hand. Try to humiliate me. I know you're a sadist. You snubbed me at that party in Cleveland. Come on, cut my head. So I was leaving it dangling out there, right? And now the danger was that when I went to parry, if I went too far, if I overcompensated, he would quickly move and cut me here. That was the danger of going for that. So, but I'm leaving it out there. I'm leaving it out there. I'm drawing him in. He's moving back and forth. It's a beautiful dance fencing. And then suddenly, sure enough, he makes his move. He goes for my hand. I wait till the last second. Boom, I parry him. It was beautiful. It was delicious. It was a wonderful clang of steel. I had him blocked. Now, and his head was right there because he had extended himself. So all I had to do was go like that, tap him right on the head, and I win. All I had to do was go like, tap him right on the head. Now, I've been fencing, like everything in life, the closest distance between two points is a straight line. So just like that, planar, like the coach had been telling me. But instead, like an idiot, like an inner loser, like blinded Oedipus, I rear back like that, exposing my arm. You fool, I sense my foolishness. But Russell Wilson was so shocked that I parried him. I still had time. So I compensated, and I came down ferociously on top of his said like that, Ela! And I went so nuts, so much craziness, my whole life, so much confusion, all came out right on his head, and my saber snapped and broke over his head, went flying into the air, probably blinded a co-ed, Barnard. It went flying into the air. It was beautiful. And I went like that, and I had scored the touch, but then I went nuts. I started going, Ela! 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 It was like I had French Tourette's. I was like a dog in an alleyway making love like the greatest lover ever. Up and down this pumping motion, the Elas, the whole place was going crazy. And the judge, who was actually a Holocaust survivor with one eye and a lump and a bad leg, somehow he'd seen this. Nobody could miss that I'd broken the blade over his head. And he goes, touch to the left, to Ames, to Princeton. And I had won. Whoever wins in life, no one. That's why we're here tonight. You never win. But I had won, and I was lifted up by my teammates, the greatest fencing victory of my life. I was ebullient. And then I saw Russell Wilson down below, just kind of dizzy, and I said, oh, nice bout, completely disingenuous, but showing good form, and we shook hands. And so that is the story of my greatest fencing victory.
That was Jonathan Ames at a Moth Night we produced with the Penn World Voices Festival. There's a coda to that story, and it's on our website, themoth.org, along with a photo of Jonathan from college in fencing gear posing on the Jersey Shore. In addition to being a novelist, Jonathan is the creator of the HBO series Bored to Death. The Moth Radio Hour will continue in a moment.
The Moth is supported by Makers 46, handcrafted bourbon finished in barrels with seared French oak staves, online at makers46.com. Makers 46 bourbon whiskey, 47% alcohol by volume, distilled in Loretto, Kentucky, reminds listeners to drink responsibly. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
I'm Robin Young. The new movie Pride tells the true story of the alliance between London's gay and lesbian community and striking British mine workers in the 1980s.
Truth told, you're the first geese I've ever met in my life.
As far as you're aware.
That's true.
And you're the first miner I've ever met.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, producing director of The Moth. Our next story is from Audrey Pleasant from a Moth Night that featured outstanding stories from our Moth Shop community series. Moth workshops are taught to high school students and to adults and community groups. We look for people who might otherwise not come to us, and we bring them to our stage. Here's Audrey live at The Moth.
Tommy Johnson. That was my humiliator. I mean, at the age of 13, how could you be so humiliated? Let me not get ahead of myself. You see, I was going to a church right across the street from me. That was at 141st Street in Harlem, between 7th and 8th Avenue. They had a center down there that we used to go down to dance. My dance step, side to side shuffle. Side to side shuffle, regardless of what type of music it was. And I would go there and I'd sit on the side where the young ladies would sit that didn't get a chance to dance too much. And I would sit and sit. And this young man by the name of Tommy Johnson would come and ask me to dance. I'd get up and I'd follow him out to the dance floor like the moth to the flame. And we get out there, Tommy would do slides, turns, splits, bend over and shake a tail feather. And I would do my little favorite step, sigh, sigh, sigh. Regardless of what he did, I would sigh, sigh, sigh. That was my movements. Well, Tommy did this so much, and I got tired of it. I mean, I really got tired of it. And I went home one night after being humiliated, and I laid on my bed crying and thinking about Tommy and his splits and his turns and his bending over and shaking a tail feather. I thought about doing a step. I said, I could do this. I could do this. I got up off that bed, got my belt out of the closet, put it on the doorknob, tightened it up, closed that door, and I started doing me some slides. Almost tripped over my own foot, but I still did my slides. And I bent over and I shook a tail feather. I even did a little twirling. Then I did the half split. I couldn't do the whole split, of course, but the half split would suffice me. And I kept this up for a whole month. I mean, I would eat. I would stop and eat, yes. I'd stop and go to school. I had to go to school because my mother wasn't going to have that. And I'd come back home, do my homework, have my dinner, go to my room, and I'd do my little dancing. I'd practice and practice and practice. One night the closet door came open. I bumped my head, but I just shook that off and kept right on dancing. And I even practiced doing a headstand. I bumped my head again on the floor, shook that off, and tried it again till I got it. Like I said, I did that for a whole month till I felt I had it together. And then one night, one Friday night, at 6 o'clock, I got dressed and I went down to the center. And I sat in my same little spot. Now, I don't know who Tommy was dancing with while I was gone, but I guess he was dancing with somebody. But I sat in my same spot, waiting, just waiting for him to come over and ask me to dance. True to form, here comes Mr. Tommy Johnson. And I got up, and I followed him out to the dance floor. Now, when you get out there on the dance floor, if you're really doing something spectacular, a crowd will gather around you. Now, that crowd is there to help you stay inside the circle, to let the person that's doing the fantastic dancing do their thing. And if you're not dancing so good and you try to get out that circle, you can't go nowhere. You got to stay inside that circle and endure the humiliation. Well, Tommy had asked me to dance again, and I was inside the circle. And he was doing his splits. He was doing his turns, his slides. I mean, he had it going on. He was sliding all over the place and then bending over and shaking a tail feather. And I let him go right ahead. Go ahead, slide some more. Do the split. Shake a tail feather. And he even galloped like he was riding a pony. I said, yeah, go right ahead. Go right ahead. And I got tired of looking at him doing all his slides and everything. And I slid up to his face, and he stood there with his mouth wide open, looking at me all wide-eyed, all bug-eyed. And I showed him what I could do. I showed him my slides. And I mean, I slide. You could think I was James Brown. I was sliding so good. And I showed him how I could bend over and shake a tail feather. And I went and did me a half split, which I could do. Did it pretty good, too. And he just stood there looking at me with his mouth wide open, all buggy eyed, like he was. He tried to walk out the circle. But they wouldn't let him out. They came in tighter and enforced it. And that made me more determined to do my slides, my shake a tail feather. And I even did like the pony, too. Showed him I knew what I could do. And then when I tired of him, I slid up to his face again and threw him a kiss. Let him know that, hey, you ain't got it all like that. I got me a little bit of it, too. and I walked out of that circle. Now, I didn't go back to the center for a while, and I didn't know what happened to Tommy Johnson. But anyway, one day I was walking down 125th Street between 7th and 8th Avenue, the Apollo Theater's down there, and then across the street there was a store called the Record Shack. And they were playing some music. I mean, they were throwing down. And it was one of James Brown's records, too. And I just, something just came over me, and I started dancing. Next thing I knew, I had a crowd of people around me, and I just showed off even more so. And this man stepped out of the audience, and he said, "You know what, miss? You should be at the Apollo Theater." I looked at that man like he was crazy. He said, "I'm serious." He said, "Here." He said, "This, come here at this time and on this date." I took the paper and I said, well, I couldn't lose. I might gain something. And on that day, and at that precise time, I went to the Apollo Theater. And they had a group of performing up there called the Coasters. And the lead singer was Speedo. He would come down and interact with the audience. He would take the mic and he would put it to somebody. He'd say, "Whoa." And then he'd put the mic to somebody's mouth and they said nothing. He went to the next person. "Whoa." He got nothing. He came to me. He said, "Whoa." I said, "Wow." He jumped back and looked at me and he grabbed my hand and he pulled me up on the stage. And that's the first time in my life I had ever seen anybody do the twist on one leg while they got the other leg extended in front of them. Well, I couldn't do that. So I did the best thing I could do. I turned around and showed him my posterior jumping up one at a time. And he took off his shirt. But when he went to take off his pants, I screamed. And I ran off the stage. I hurried up and got back to my seat. The usher came down with a flashlight and he was shining in my face. I said, "Oh gosh, did I do something wrong?" He said, "Miss, come here." And I got up and I went to him. He said, "The manager wants to see you." And I thought to myself, I'm going to get put out of the theater. They're going to put me out. They're really going to put me out. And I paid to come in here. But I went up to the manager, brave, very brave. He said, "Are you working anywhere, miss?" I said, "No, sir." Now here I'm 13 years old. And he said, "Would you like to appear here on the stage with the Coasters for the rest of the week?" Would I? Yes. He said, "You'll get paid Friday, just like they do." I said, "Thank you." He said, "You wouldn't have to go up on the stage every show, but be here every day." And I was true to form. I was here every day. I went up on the stage some of the times. And one time I was up there on the stage, and who made an appearance but James Brown himself. I said, "Wow." Then I really did something then. I did my slide. And I had trained myself so well that I could do the slide and make it in a figure eight. He looked at me and he said, "Wow, little mama." That became my stage name, Little Mama. And from there, I went to the Carver Ballroom, the Renaissance Ballroom, the Audubon Ballroom, the Baby Grand, Small's Paradise, and I did my slide and my bend over and shake a tail feather. I even did the fly. And I stopped doing my little side to side. That was off the hook. No more doing that. I'm no more doing that. But you see, I never knew what happened to Tommy Johnson. But deep down in my heart, I thanked him for humiliating me the way he did. Because it made me more determined. And I mean, I was determined to show him that I was not going to be a little step. Step, 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 step. I was going to show him something. And I showed him. And I showed the ones that held me back in that circle that I could do something. Hold him back and let me do my thing. Whoa! Mama got a brand new bag.
That was Audrey Pleasant. Audrey actually postponed hip surgery so she could tell her story with us on the Moth main stage. Even now, in her 70s, she can still shake a tail feather. Check the website for a photo of her in her star-studded gown on stage at the Moth. Turns out Audrey's also a poet and recently won a poetry contest in her Bronx community. A copy of that poem is also on our website, themoth.org. You are listening to the Moth Radio Hour. Sometimes moth storytellers can stop us in our tracks with their brutal honesty. That was true for our next storyteller, David Carr. David shocked the crowd with this story at an open mic story slam before developing it for the Moth main stage. We want to warn you that his story has serious and adult themes, and it's not appropriate for children. Here's David Carr, live at the Moth, from an evening called The Late Late Show, Stories of Life After Dark.
I type for a living. I don't usually tell stories. This one took place back in 1988 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on a cold November night. My mother told me, and this is the first lie in this story, that nothing good happens after midnight. Everything good happens after midnight. Got your f***ing, you fucking, you drugging, you drinking. Everything good happens after midnight. Daytime is for suckers. People with straight jobs that make jelly beans or sell insurance. Nighttimes, that's cop and robber time. I was the kind of kid, as a very young man, at 10 o'clock at night, I'd just snap awake and just stare down the night, full of possibility. Just love it. Just love every single second of it. My appreciation, indeed, my enjoyment of the night increased. On my 21st birthday, I tried coke. Kind of a nocturnal phenomenon. I didn't really get it at first. I mean, I did a gram and I said, what's the big deal? I sold my car and bought an ounce. I couldn't figure it out. What are people getting so riled up about? And then I sold my house and bought a kilo. I never cracked the code on what the big deal with coke was. It does have some sort of effects on how you view day and night. Nighttime offers opportunity, unfolds out, stretches out before you. Daytime implicates everything you see indicts you. Your shitty house, your shitty job, friends. Everything about the day sucks. But nighttime now, that's when things rock. The thing is, when you're a junkie, which is what I became, going to bed gets to be kind of tough. That's like the hardest thing in the world, to go to bed. They call it surrendering to sleep for a reason. You don't want to give up. You really don't. On that night in November of 1988 in Minnesota, I was home with my brand new babies, little twin girls. It was cold out. We were all safe at home, which is where I should have stayed and gone to bed. But I couldn't. I was out. I had nothing. Their mom was off God knows where, doing God knows what, and it was me and these babies. So I called up my friend Kenny, and I said, Kenny, I'm looking. He said, well, what a coincidence. I got. I said, can you come over? He said, no, I got a house full of coke sluts and knuckleheads and willing customers. You'll have to come here. And so I stand there. It's cold out. And I do what any good junkie would do. I bundle them up in snow suits, put them in some baby buckets, and take them out to my 78 Nova, which was a box that my brother bought me out of pity. And we wobble our way from North Minneapolis down to South Minneapolis. I pull into 32nd and Garfield. I look for a dark spot, not really a terrible neighborhood, but not a great one. And I shut off the car, go silent. And as my eyes adjust to the darkness, I can see in the back seat, I can see those little snowsuits, those little babies dreaming their little baby dreams, their little blue snowsuits. And I do the math. Could I bring them in? Come into the dope house, swinging a couple baby buckets. Not good, not done. Bad manners. I thought about leaving. That's the second lie. I didn't really think about leaving. And then I thought, 5 minutes, in and out, no harm, no foul, I'll be riding home. God will look after them while I do not. How tough can it be? I gave it some more thought. There was a sudden tumbling. I stepped out of the car and went inside, locked the door. As dope houses go, this one had a lot to commend it. Kenny, the guy that ran it, he had kind of this mad professor coke rap that made it seem somehow interesting, like he had made a studio out of his place and there were rock people that hang out. And he had a coke rap that I just enjoyed. It was all kind of black helicopters, white noise, they're coming to get us, kind of thing that would keep you on your toes. So I went in, and it was your typical tableau. Keep in mind that cocaine is not like heroin. Heroin is like a Jim Jarmusch movie where, you know, starts slow and then just kind of sort of goes along. And eventually you fall asleep, right? Coke is a lot more like Quentin Tarantino. A lot of blood, a lot of mayhem, a lot of equipment. Every 20 minutes, you got to do it. And if you're an IV coke user, which I was, it takes a lot of equipment, a lot of effort. So I go in, and shooting coke, if it's done properly, is kind of like an Olympic pairs event. You do it together. High risk of overdose shooting coke. Because the objective when you're shooting it is to come really close to overdosing, but not die. You want to be right up to the edge. So you have somebody pushing it in for you, because if you push it in too far and you get too high and can't pull it out, then so somebody will, you'll say, push it in slow, but push it in large, okay? They push it. Are you good? Your ears are ringing. A little more. Push it in a little more. Your blood starts to boil. Are you good? Almost. Push it in all the way. I'm good. I am so good. Time becomes elastic in those circumstances. You're always going to leave in just 2 minutes. Did I think of those babies out in that car? I don't want to lie, so I'm not going to say. I don't know. I was always just going to go, but then, you know, people would talk, and the thing is he had this, he built it like a studio, so there's this acoustic tile everywhere, and there's these guitars and drums, and we could pretend like we were there to jam, but it was as plain as a pile on the scale, what we were all there for, right? And Kenny, who was just a complete paranoid, decided that there were little video cameras in those, all those acoustic tiles, right? In this room full of geeking people, that we were being watched by black helicopters and the video cameras in there. And so in a move of junkie solidarity, we decided, you know what, we'll inspect each hole, and went through the panels. And we each got a pencil and started marking off the holes as they went. And of course, Kenny spilled a bunch of coke while we were doing it. Time passed. I won't say that I came to my senses, but eventually the machine bucked, it smoked, it threw me clear. And I went out past the three deadbolt locks on the front door and stepped out on that wooden porch and listened to my hollow steps, wondering, looking at that 78 Nova, feeling the chill of that night and feeling the chill in my soul and thinking, had God looked after them? Well, I had not. I did not run to that car. I was not anxious to get to that car. I walked to it nice and slow. I opened up the front door nice and slow. Unlocked the back door nice and slow. Pulled open that door. I could see their breath. So, God had looked after them, by proxy me, but as I got in that car and drove off into that chilly night, I knew that I had done something that he would not soon forgive. Thanks for listening.
That was David Carr. David is a columnist at the New York Times and recently wrote the best-selling memoir, The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life, his own. To learn more about all of our programs, go to themoth.org, where you can also check out our weekly podcast. If you have a story to share, you can tell us about it right on our website. That's themoth.org. In a moment, we'll hear two stories from our Open Mic Story Slam series, one from Detroit and one from Los Angeles.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of how the birth control pill was invented. We talk with Jonathan Eig, author of the new book, The Birth of the Pill, how four crusaders reinvented sex and launched a revolution. In the 50s, when the scientists Eig writes about were conducting their research into the pill, many states and the federal government still had anti-contraception laws on the books. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and you're listening to the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. The three stories in this hour so far were told on the Moth main stage, the curated Moth, where the stories are directed ahead of time. But next, you'll hear two shorter stories from our Open Mic Story Slam competition. At Moth Story Slams, people show up, names go in a hat, 10 tellers get picked and have 5 minutes to tell a story. Only one is declared a winner. This story is from Christine Blackburn. She told it at a recent Los Angeles slam. The theme was rules.
So I used to be a flight attendant. And the flight attendant school, like the training that we had to go to, was absolutely ridiculous. And they had so many rules. And you could be kicked out for anything at any time. Like the wrong color nail polish, or like if your earrings were bigger than a quarter, or if you weren't wearing a beige bra. And like for some reason, I thought like being a flight attendant, a lot of the training would be focused on like safety. How to open an emergency door, you know, maybe use a fire extinguisher. But really, it was all about making weight. Every week, we had to stand in a big auditorium in a single file, and they would call our name one by one. And they would. One lady had like a clipboard, and she would shout, "Blackburn, 5'4", can weigh 120." And then another, and then I'd step out there, "Does weigh 119." And like I would always just make it, but it was very, very serious. And if you didn't make weight, you were out there and then, right then, bam. They put you on a van, they take you to the airport, and they fly you back to wherever you came from. No, it was very serious. I burned through like 3 roommates because of the weight thing. Super crazy. And then they were also very into the uniform, right? So we had to wear like navy pumps and navy nylons all the time through the terminal and boarding and deplaning, unless we were actually serving, and then we could put our flats on. For like 7 years, I wore navy pumps and beige bras. Very, very unattractive. They were also very big on our serving garment. The serving garment was like an apron. And you could only wear the serving garment when you were serving food, when you were boarding and deplaning, you had to have on your blazer. So that was a whole different thing. And to illustrate this and how important it was, one time during accident week, which is like shark week, but with airplane accidents, we were watching this Air Florida crash, and maybe you remember it in the early 80s. This jet just flew right into the Potomac River, into a bridge, and everybody died except for like five people. And it was in January, and it was freezing, and there's like icebergs in the water, and we're watching this tape, and there's a flight attendant being pulled out of the water, dangling on a rope by a helicopter, the whole thing. She's being carried away, and the instructor stops the VCR, and she says, "You see that? Is that what you want? You want to be on national television in your serving garment?" So, just to illustrate how exactly ridiculous all of these rules were, I did graduate training, and 6 months later, I'm taking a flight. I'm going from JFK to West Palm Beach, and I'm flying, and I'm working first class, and this lady comes suddenly between the curtains, and she comes up, and she whispers in my ear, "Excuse me, stewardess. Just so you know, Mr. Klein in 5C just passed away." I'm sorry, what? And she goes, "I'm his nurse, he's dead." And she turns around and she walks back through the curtain and she sits down. And I'm thinking, well, there has to be a rule for this, you know. So I go to the flight attendant manual and there is a rule. Boom. If a passenger dies in your flight, do not panic. Act naturally. Place an oxygen mask over their nose and mouth. Adjust the elastic band around your head. And you may want to put a blanket in their lap. So I head back between the curtains. I head back to coach with an oxygen bottle and a blanket. And I walk through the curtain and I see the dude. And he's like 150. And he's like dead, 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 dead. And I'm like, "Hey, Mr. Klein, I heard you're not feeling well." And I'm putting on the oxygen mask, you know, bang, you know. "Hey, I'm adjusting the air thing. Would you like a blanket? Here's the blanket, here's the oxygen mask." So I go back and I tell the pilots, I'm like, "You guys, he's dead, and the nurse, and he's dead." And they said, "Well, you know, that's what it is. So we have to continue the flight." And now we land in West Palm Beach, you know, I get out of my serving garment, I put my blazer back on, you know, I put my heels back on. And we land, and I think, okay, this is obvious, we're going to take all the passengers off and then get the dead guy off. But no, 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 that's not the rules. The rule is the dead guy goes off first. So we pull up to the gate, I open the door, these freaking paramedics like rush in and the whole charade continues. They've got like a straight back chair and they're like, "Oh, we're coming, Mr. Klein. Don't you worry." And they're like, "We got you, don't you worry, sir. Put your hands over your chest. We're gonna," and they strap him around this like dolly and then they dolly him off. But who am I to break the rules? I said, "Okay, take care, Mr. Klein. Nice flying with us. Thanks so much. You have a great day."
That was Christine Blackburn. Christine is a stay-at-home mom and a former Peace Corps volunteer. This next and last story was told at the Moth Story Slam series in Detroit. The theme was cars. Here's James Foster live at the Moth.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you. My story has to do with a 1996 Grand Marquis Mercury that I picked up from my father when he bought a new car. I got it when my daughter was in high school so that I could have a second car to get her to and from school. And we had a brief relationship. I got this car about 5 years ago, and it was pretty reliable. But the main part of the story has to do with the time that I got the car stolen and how I got the car stolen. I live in Detroit. I've been a lifelong Detroit resident. I'm third-generation Detroiter. I'm not easily bamboozled. I'm not easily scammed. I've seen panhandlers and people trying to get you at the gas station for a couple of bucks. But this guy was good. This guy was real good. He got me. I'm loading tools in the car to go over to my dad's to do a little work. Guy comes up and says, can you help me? And I right away say, no, can't help you. No. He said, I've got a couple bucks. I just need you to give me a ride over to get my car a jump. Now, most of the time, people are trying to scam you. They don't have $2 in their hand offering it to you. So I listened. He said his van broke down. He's just around the corner on the freeway off the lodge. He just needs a jump. Now, give me a couple. I said, oh, okay. Maybe this time I'll do the guy a favor. So he gets in the car with me. You drive around. There's actually a van there. So, okay, stories make a little bit more sense. The hood's up on the van. I say, okay, I've got jumper cables. I figure, 30 seconds, I'm going on with my life. Raise the hood on my car. He gets in the van. He fools around. Nothing's happening with the van, even with the cables on it. So we're sitting there for a while trying to get the car started. Finally, he says, you try to start the van. I'll tinker under the hood while you try to start the van, because I know the van. I should be able to start it. I'm a little leery, but, the hood's up on my car. It's got jumper cables on it. I figured what could happen. So we're on the lodge service drive. I'm trying to, turn the key in the van. And as I look down, it's not really a key. It's a screwdriver in the ignition of the van. Yeah, a little suspicious, but he offered me a couple dollars. So then he gets very concerned. He says, these people sure are flying up the service drive. Maybe you better pull your car off to the side while we try to figure out what's wrong with the van. So he says, you take the cables off and then I'll move your car. Now the hood's up on the car. I'm outside the car. I say, okay, I'll take the cables off. I see my car going northbound on the lodge service drive with the hood up. With the hood up. He makes it all the way to the forest entrance to the lodge freeway, stops, puts the hood down. Gone. Now, the police do recover the car a few weeks later, minus the catalytic converter, the aluminum wheels, even take the visors off from, to block the sun. But I got the last laugh. Thanks to President Obama and Cash for Clunkers. I traded it in, got the $4,500, and got a new car. So it all worked out.
That was James Foster at our Story Slam series in Detroit. Special thanks to WDET, our media sponsor, for the ongoing support of the Detroit Slams. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. If you want to hear more Moth, go to themoth.org, where you can learn all about our programs. All the stories you heard today are available at the iTunes store. Just search for The Best of the Moth. Do you have a moth story? We want to hear it. Log on to themoth.org to record your pitch right on the web.
In 1984, when I was 22, I was still a virgin. I had no girlfriend. I had no options. I had no clue. I ran across an ad for the Institute for Sexual Surrogate Therapy, and I enrolled. I enrolled with my best friend and roommate, who is also a virgin, and we found out we had the same surrogates.
Remember, you can call our pitch hotline at 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. We hope you'll tune in next time, and that's the story from The Moth.
Your host this hour was The Moth's producing director, Sarah Austin Jeunesse. Sarah also directed the stories in this hour, along with Catherine Burns. The rest of The Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Remember to pitch us your own story at themoth.org, like these people did.
I am the Elephant Man. I have had two African elephants for over 30 years, the largest land animal that walks the face of the earth.
This one time in fifth grade, I hypnotized this girl, and then I couldn't bring her back.
Production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Echter. Larry Rosen is the Moth's Moth Shop Coordinator.
I am the sole survivor of three caught in an avalanche on Valentine's Day, 1989, in southwestern Colorado.
Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour, The March from El Cid, Shake a Tail Feather by James and Bobby Purify, Night Hotel by John Zorn, and the theme from Grand Theft Auto by Michael Hunter.
My dad was teaching a course in the atomic bomb, and he was always kind of emotionally unavailable to me. I knew he loved me, but he never really made it very, very clear. And at the beginning of the summer, he said he wanted to build